Patrick, former congressman, author of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act.
Stephen Fried, journalist and author.
So what inspired you, inspire both you to create the book?
Well, Stephen and I, Stephen helped me write my own story called A Common Struggle. And we had a great, working relationship as a result of that. And, we figured that we could replicate that, but do it, in magazine length kind of chapters and kind of get the benefit of a more of a deep dive into what it's like living with these illnesses. And Stephen was so good at kind of wrapping in my medical records with my recollection of what had happened. And then, of course, he interviewed everyone around me. So that tempered what I remembered as what happened. And it gave us just a much more realistic version of what actually I went through. And that process is what we basically replicated here with 12 people. And really, this is not a narrative that you often see in mental health because you just hear the first person narrative. You don't hear the family members, the coworkers, the friends, and or the psychiatrist or medical professionals. And that's exactly what we did in this. So I think for Americans who only hear that someone has a diagnosis, they're now having a little bit better understanding of what a diagnosis means to someone in their daily life, as opposed to people just thinking that they're being transparent simply because they say they have a diagnosis, which of course, thankfully, people are a little bit more open about. But what they're not open about is how does that actually manifest in their lives? And that's how we approach this book, is to get that day-to-day experience that people have living with these illnesses, trying to negotiate family relationships, business, and their medical care. And that I think will help make less people more people less uncomfortable and isolated, because they're not going to feel like they're all alone with their illnesses. And the last thing I'll say is I'm in 12-step recovery. We have a book of stories of fellows who have experienced addiction and alcoholism, and it really is meant to help people feel less unique, and in feeling less unique, they're less isolated. But we don't really have that for people who don't live in the 12-step world. So it's also kind of an attempt to take the benefit of that type of approach to people who have mental illness and addiction. Of course, we never cover these as a continuum. We either say it's a mental illness or it's an addiction. But in this book, we talk about the reality that it's often both at the same time.
We've been having the discussion about the fact that people don't understand the real world of having these illnesses as long as we've known each other, and we've known each other for 13 years. The first idea we had was that if we did a memoir with Patrick, which was much more than his story, also gave people the background of all the politics, that they would understand the struggle. Because what Patrick just identified, the idea that these ideas exist, but they just don't exist for everybody. So there are things that happen in 12-step that people with mental illness, people who don't do 12-step, know nothing about. So part of Patrick's advocacy and my journalism has always been to point out to people that if these worlds all just shared best practices, respected each other's treatments, respected their differences, you would have a huge community of people who identify as having being treated with mental illness, being treated all different ways for addiction, all different ways for mental illness, and they would be more likely politically to get what they wanted. So we tried a book that was more political, which was Patrick's story. And then really, when Simone Biles was being pilloried every day on television during the 2021 Olympics, we started texting each other. And it's again, it's not like we never had this idea before, but We really just said, like, when is it going to get to the point where somebody really understands what it's like to have these illnesses? If you're a journalist or a friend, what questions you're supposed to ask to show that you actually understand? Because, this poor woman is in the middle of this thing and people don't even want to know the answers. All they want is what Patrick always heard from his dad when he was a kid, which is, just like, just snap out of it. Just snap out of it. So, we said, it would be great if we could tell individual stories so that it's not just one story. And in our dream, it was, what if we could create something that was like almost like a Profiles in Courage for mental health? And I mean, that's what we called it from the very beginning. And then we just started figuring out how you do that, because you can't just call up all your friends and say, will you tell us your stories? Also, we didn't want Patrick's friends. We wanted to talk to people who hadn't come out already, who hadn't already turned their stories into activism. We wanted people to tell their stories for the first time. And so we started reaching out, everybody in Patrick's Rolodex, everybody in my Rolodex, everybody in everybody's Rolodex, just to let them know, we're going to do this book. We're looking for a group of special people who are willing to be really interviewed in depth and maybe share their medical records, maybe connect us with family members, loved ones, people they had broken up with because of their mental illness, that exists too. And just really do a good job and have it be diverse by age, by race, by diagnosis, by gender. And we just started interviewing everybody. We did over 100 pre-Zoom interviews. I mean, you should have seen the calendars for this. One day we did a Zoom interview with the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, the head of National Institute of Drug Abuse, and the head of IAA, because they just happened to line up that day. But, Patrick has a great Rolodex and people respect his, they'll take his call. At the same time, to get them to turn us on to somebody who might talk to us, that's a much harder ask. And then some of the people that we did meet with then, when they found out that we were going to use people's real names, felt that that wasn't for them. And one of the biggest challenges of this whole process in 2 years is that we told people from the very beginning that they could withdraw from the book at any time if they decided that they were not comfortable with this level of revelation, even up to publication. And I will say that a couple people did. And I will say that I had a lot of late nights worried up against publication time, whether others would too. And but the 12 people who were in the book were stayed with it. And, but they should have that choice. It was a very active process. And our relationship with these people is still very active. They feel understood by us. They understand that we care about their illnesses. And, people with mental illness and addiction, I understand that 12-step meetings are supposed to be, in the traditional way, are supposed to be a secret. But I think one of the biggest things is to suggest that maybe they don't need to be a secret, and that if people felt more open about talking about their illnesses, maybe we could expand how empathized with they are and improve their health. So that's big picture what we were sort of hoping for.
And for me, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder 2 5 years ago. And one of the first things I did was Google celebrities with bipolar disorder, and I found a Wikipedia page, but it wasn't anything I could really relate to, and it wasn't just normal people going through life. So you guys worked on great stories with great people. Why do you think those stories are more impactful?
Well, we did try to get some celebrities, but of course, there, to your point, reticent to really share more right. than, people who are just living their lives with these illnesses and frankly can have the ability to share more than maybe but a celebrity. But frankly, that's better. It wasn't part of our intention, but it worked out better for us because, to your point, we want people to really share it all. And, if you're a real big celebrity, you're self-editing a lot. And that's not, the point of the book. So I think people will be more, ironically, will be more, you look at People magazine, they have to, do the sizzle for the celebrity to get people to pick up the magazine. We're getting people to pick up the book because the critics have said it's more valuable to get the in-depth story than it is to get the People magazine version, which, as I said, is not a realistic portrayal of people's real experience. So, anyway.
Well, I mean, look, we asked very widely, and I will note, look, Gabrielle Anwar is a very, very well-known actress. Solomon Thomas is an NFL defensive back. It's not like there's nobody in the book that isn't known. But our goal was to have balance. And I will also say, look, I started out writing these kinds of stories, and some of them were about well-known people. One of them was about Patrick. I mean, part of the reason that I ended up writing with Patrick was because I did a piece about Patrick and his then fiance. In which they were incredibly open about his struggle with addiction and his struggle with bipolar disorder. And you know, if you're bipolar, you know about Kay Jamison, you know about the books that she wrote. The first piece where she came out and talked about being bipolar was again a piece that I wrote for the Washington Post magazine before her famous memoir, An Unquiet Mind. I do believe that everybody can tell a deeply narrative story about their mental illness, and part of what I hope for is that more and more people will, that they'll do it while they're alive. When we lose people to suicide and overdose, I want those stories to be better told because I think it's important. So in this book, we have 10 people who are main characters who are living. We have two families that lost people to suicide. And those suicide-related pieces are about recreating the life of the person in three dimensions, asking all kinds of different medical, social, family questions, without judgment. And so I think it is possible, and I would like to think that people could read a book like this and think, you know, a lot of people could share these stories.
You both talked a little bit about talking to family members and friends and all that. Was that important to you to capture their side of the story as well?
Well, this is a book for everybody, you know, not just people who are living and challenged by the diagnosis, but you know, their family who's also living and challenged by the diagnosis, and their stories aren't often included. And so, you know, this is not an illness that's one in four, like you read the statistics. This is one in one because everybody's impacted. And I think we've lost that perspective. And we think that this is just about people who themselves are suffering. But, you know, frankly, the whole country's suffering because one of your family members is suffering. Everybody in the family is affected.
It's very unusual, again, in families where there's a living person with these illnesses or after a suicide or overdose, for somebody as nose people's nosy as me and Patrick, but nosy for a reason, meaning, right, we're not just there saying, you know, tell me something so that I can know a piece of information. We're saying, like, look, this information could be powerful if we could tell it to people in a way that was useful. Okay. And so when you interview somebody and they say, they tell you about something with their family member and they say, can we talk to the family member? That conversation then becomes interesting and different. And then after the family member talks to us, you can go back to them and say, look, your mom said this or your spouse said this. We had fascinating conversations. And Patrick and I used to just like kind of look at each other in amazement at how open people were being with spouses, where we would go back and forth between the spouses to get information. We talked to Patrick's cousin and his cousin, who's his age, and his cousin's son, who's younger, about the death of their son. And they had never had a conversation about this in the 7 years since his death. So what you can do is not just get somebody to talk. I mean, we all know what it's like to go to a meeting where somebody stands up and wants to tell their story. They want to share their lived experience. It's incredibly hard to share your lived experience off the top of your head with people who don't know you. And so often, you know, what happens is you say a lot of things, but people don't connect it. To make those lived experience stories mean something to somebody who doesn't know you takes a different kind of writing and a different kind of journalism, and for people to ask a lot more questions so they can understand what's going on. And that's what we were able to do with these 12 people at great length. And then for the ones who were up for it, we would ask them to get their medical records or to connect us with their treating physicians, and we talked to them. So, you know, and the idea was to find the things that we thought people should know more about. And we also try to, without, like, there's hardly any statistics in this book, there's no footnotes. You know, the goal was every time we thought the reader needed to understand something that they may not know off the top of their head, to explain it in as short a way as possible and get back to the story, because that's what makes the people and their challenges come through, the darkest parts of their stories, the most inspiring parts of their stories. And when you look at people longitudinally in their illness, their stories all have all of those things. Whereas I know, being a journalist, in journalism, we only look for the story at the most inspiring part or the most horrible part, because honestly, that's what we get access to. But in this book, you get access to a much longer, more real life story. I mean, you've been bipolar for 5 years. That's only 5 years. You have, you know, longer, hopefully, to be treated well, for your symptoms to be under control. It's a long expedition. We also looked for people who had been ill long enough that they had had not remissions, but they had been better. They'd been worse. They had, right. You know, because that also shows the real world. You know, the biggest thing, Patrick always said this, the first biggest thing for people to do is to admit they have the illness and they're being treated. The even harder one is to come back to somebody and say, I have the illness. It's gotten worse again. Even though I've been taking my meds and doing my therapy and doing my meetings, but it got worse again, because that's how the illnesses work. For people around you to be able to understand that, that's a big deal. And that's one of the things that I think we were able to capture in the book.
How did it feel for you to build a relationship with the people you profiled?
Well, it was great. You know, we have 12 new friends, and because of the book, you know, you dive into more of a real and more of an intimate and connected relationship than we all have generally in society, where we're, you know, trying to maintain our image and reputation, and, you know, we self-edit and don't open our true selves up. So we don't really have a good feeling for how everybody is in this world, even people who are often closest to us. So what I found, the reason I do 12-step recovery, you know, just so passionately, is because it's a place where you can really connect with people who understand, and you can have more transparent, you know, more connected conversations than what society usually allows you to have. So we kind of, you know, this was kind of like that experience for me, you know, when people really open up, and I was able to, you know, open up to them too in the process. So, you know, in order to kind of encourage them and remind them that I had told my story too. So, of course I shared my, narrative, and that helped them kind of know that was the kind of model we wanted to replicate.
And there were things, you know, even though Patrick did a whole memoir we did together in 2015, there were things that he revealed to the people we were during the interviews of this book that he didn't reveal during the book, or that happened after the book. And so while we didn't want the attention so much to be on Patrick, we wanted people to understand that those kinds of conversations are about give and take. I mean, that's why people have them with you, because they know you're being open with them. And the other thing I will point out is that because of the secrecy of this, and because everybody could leave the project no matter when, while Patrick and I had a relationship with the people that we'd been interviewing, and both of our assistants, I mean, my assistant had one, Patrick's assistant was also reading over our shoulder. Those are the only four people who saw anything we were doing for 2 years. The publisher didn't even see the first chapters of the book until last fall, because again, we didn't know if once we showed them to the people in the book, whether they would allow us to be in it. So we knew these people, they knew us, but it was all quite secret. And what's been fascinating is that since the book is done, since it's printed, we can be more open about who's in the book. Two, the people from the book are meeting each other. Patrick and I had this profound experience 2 weeks ago in Washington and New York, where we were with multiple people from the book at the same time for the first time, and they were talking to each other. And it's so powerful. And also, no matter what they told us in the book, I will tell you that every time that they've been interviewed since the book came out, we did a Zoom with a couple of them last night with my Columbia class. It's amazing. They're so amazing in their ability to be free to talk about what's going on with them. And that has such amazing power.
What have you learned from each other?
Well, I've been reminded on what a great writer Stephen is, because I mean, honestly, he's my Ted Sorensen. You know, he's a brilliant writer, and frankly, there aren't many who can write in a way that is not salacious or prurient or, you know, scandalous, because that's really, unfortunately, what we're used to, and we don't really have this covered as if it were any other kind of physical challenge. And you know, the symptoms, you know, so much judgment on symptoms, as if people choose to alienate their friends and family. They choose to put their lives at risk for either death or for incarceration. I mean, you know, these people really, unfortunately, conflate you know, symptoms that people have from these illnesses as, you know, really personal choices people make. But if you think about it, no one makes these choices to live these experiences. And but you have to remind them. And I think writing it in a very kind of factual way takes the that kind of salacious aspect of it out of the narrative. It's not as if we're not telling the full story, but frankly, by telling more, it feels less kind of judgmental, because it's clear that no one's trying to self-edit because they're ashamed of their symptoms. The symptoms are the symptoms, so it's not them. They are their own people, and that comes through in the narrative. Them as people and the illness as something separate.
I'll say, look, I wrote about mental health for a lot of pa I'm a little bit older than Patrick, so I was writing about mental health before, not before Patrick was dealing with his own mental health, but before he was public about his mental health. We met right after he left Congress. He was planning what became the beginning of One Mind, which was the first attempt to sort of bring together all the different communities of mental illness, of addiction, of neuroscience, and try to get them to row in the same direction. And help each other. And I was recommended to him by the head of the clinical pharmacology department at Georgetown, who I had written about before. But before I started working with him, I went to Kay Jameson, who I had written about and whose story I had told. And I said, you know, I have an opportunity to work with Patrick Kennedy. What do you think about this? And she said, she knew Patrick for a long time. She said, look, if Patrick Kennedy can get well and stay well and hold it together, he is really the only hope for the future of advocacy in all these areas of mental illness and addiction. So if you working with him can do anything to improve that process, and my main goal is to be able to explain, that would be great. So, you know, for a number of years, we just worked together in messaging. I was there for some of the meetings for the Kennedy Forum, but it ultimately became these books because you have to have something that people can read separate from us. It's been my honor to have any role in this advocacy because, you know, ultimately journalists aren't supposed to do that. They're supposed to write about it, not try to do it themselves. But, you know, what I try to bring to this is if we can't explain to people what this is like to have these illnesses, to struggle with the problems that the politics are supposed to fix, then we're never going to make any progress. And so it's been a really fascinating experience. And right now in real time, it's been really fascinating because again, once you have a book come out and a book that is so personal for so many people, including us, you know, every time you talk about it and every time you talk about it with the people who were in it or people reading it, you're really moved to see how much it can touch people. And I think how much it's needed. And, you know, what we have to make sure is that as many people as possible read the book, not people who already get it. This book is for people who get it and people who totally don't get it. So in my dream, people who, like you, who have the illness, who wish people around you understood, you know, our dream is for them to say, look, could you read this? It's not about me, but it's about the bigger picture of me. And that will help me because that's exactly what we wanted it to be. We wanted it to be interesting and engaging for people who are not already part of the cause, but need to understand why the cause exists and why we have to do a much better job of being there for people with these illnesses, supporting their evidence-based treatment, and dealing with them the same way we deal with that. Look, when people have cancer, if it comes back, people know how to support and help people. In mental illness, we barely know how to support them when we first find out about it. In addiction, the same way. But in order to be with them through their whole lives, we really have to understand the courses of these illnesses. And that's why we're incredibly proud to be able to present people with bipolar disorder, people with depression, people with schizophrenia, people addicted to opiates, people addicted to alcohol, and to show the aspects of them that are different. And I will say, my wife, who's also my editor, kept saying when she was reading it, it's so interesting that so much is the same of the experiences, even though the different illnesses are different. Because the technical parts of the illnesses are different, but the way you have to deal with them in your life has a great similarity. And you could see what it would be like if people were more there. Because the other thing is, we met some powerful people in people's lives who kept them alive. You know, the college friend who basically keeps somebody who's suicidal their freshman year from taking their own life. The spouse who doesn't run away when things get really bad. The parent, you know, who sticks it out. Those kinds of characters are amazing. And why do we care about them? Well, part, you know what? Patrick's marriage is a perfect example of that. That's why I liked writing about Patrick's marriage, because he and Amy had made this commitment to his health and his future. And they had made it at a pretty early time in their relationship. And they were willing to talk about that, because I think that they understood that it would be profound for people to see how love influences the care of these illnesses.
And you, both of you, do so much to help other people's mental health with telling these stories. But what do you do to help your own mental health?
Well, I say in the book, you know, we have some evidence-based interventions, but we often don't put them together. So I have, thankfully, I've got an ASAM trained psychiatrist, because I have addiction as one of my primary diagnoses, and I can't have just a regular psychiatrist. I got to have someone who's really gets the vulnerabilities having a addiction as a diagnosis. I have, you know, peer support, which obviously I get through 12-step recovery. And I, of course, have a family that's enormously supportive. And, you know, part of my success in all recovery is helping others. So it's not a selfless endeavor. You know, we find in recovery that the more we can help others, the more we end up getting freed from our own feeling of isolation, because we're helping someone else and in the process being connected, which is, of course, so important for people with both addiction and mental illnesses diagnoses.
I mean, I personally don't have a diagnosis. I live with a number of people who do. I will say that the pressure of this book was different than any other pressure, because to have 12 people's stories and to be responsible for them is something that I've not been through before. I've written individual stories like this before, but not a number of them together. It was very challenging. You know, what happens for the writer, I have to say, honestly, is when you're doing the interviews, my rule of thumb is, if you're doing interviews, only one person could be crying. It shouldn't be the interviewer. So, you know, you're there trying to be solid for people when they're sharing something unbelievably emotional. I think it only can become emotional to you when it's done. Yeah. So I'm in that phase right now, I would say, because the book is done and now I can finally see what it is. But when you're doing this for 2 years, you really just have to hold it together for everybody else. Because, of course, you know, people had relapses during the time. You know, we got a lot of emails from people when they not just when they lost their sobriety. I mean, several people almost died during the course of the book. And thank God, you know, they're okay. But it was a lot. It was exactly like what it's really like for people with mental illness and addiction. And people kind of don't always share it. So what we really try to put forward, again, the model of Patrick's care is something that I still find people, we were on CBS News Saturday morning 2 weeks ago about this. And I always say, when Patrick describes that he's being treated by psychiatry, psychology, addiction medicine, and 12-step, and that they all have to be together, people always are like shocked. Because while Patrick and I know that that's the way that people should be looking at this, it's still a big surprise to people that you need more than one thing. They also recognize that all these fields compete against each other. Each of them, you know, you're at 5 years, you're like a newbie, okay, in bipolar disorder. You know, you're just getting acclimated to the swimming pool. So what I'm saying is you already can see, if you go to a psychologist, they tell you one thing is the thing you need mostly. If you go to a psychiatrist or your general practitioner, they tell you another thing. If you were in a peer support group just for bipolar disorder, it will be one thing. If you were in a peer support group for another thing, some people can't find a peer support group just for their illness. So in their town, they want to rely on a peer support group that's more broad. And then within the addiction community, there are the 12-step groups that are completely secret, where you don't tell anybody else, and then the more open groups. So there's a lot of siloing in these groups. But we all, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do with this book and with Common Struggle too is to make people understand the value of all of those people rowing together in the same direction. Because the one thing that hasn't happened yet is that all the people who are impacted by these illnesses, their families, don't see this as a main voting issue. They don't see this as the most important thing for them. But, you know, everybody knows every morning they wake up, the most important thing in your life is not Palestine or, you know, the economy. It's your health. It's your health. And so how do we get people who know that mental illness and addiction and suicide and overdose are the main things that are impacting our society to see that as the thing that they want to vote for? And they want to vote to support and to understand that other candidates don't even get these things. So that's, you know, we're not trying to preach in this book. We're just trying to tell stories. If you want to know the politics, there's a QR code on the last page that goes to Patrick's Alignment for Progress. And the Alignment for Progress is part of a long process in which you try to get every political goal that should exist so that people understand them. If they want, you know, how do we address this? How do we address this? What law does this? And you have to go state by state. And that's been part of Patrick's advocacy. And we want people to get to that by understanding, by reading these stories, how important it is. One of the most amazing things in this book is one couple, they cross the state line to move into a different state. They moved from Tennessee to Kentucky, and they had to redo all their care because there's you know, it's very hard to be able to take care of yourself and to deal with the fact that different states have different rules. So we're trying to get people together by having these 12 stories as be something they have in common and start from there.
So how can people reach out and learn more?
Well, you know, I have in the back, as Stephen said, a QR code to our Alignment for Progress. And that kind of gets people in terms of the policy work that we're trying to advance. And ultimately, that's what we're going to need to do if we want to get real substantive change. The book will help everybody understand the complexity of these illnesses, but the policy changes need to reflect, as Stephen just mentioned, the kind of systems change we need in order to integrate all these kind of disparate, siloed treatment modalities that, unfortunately, because they're separate, do not achieve the kind of optimal outcomes that we need them to achieve. So it's, you know, the book really helps on both fronts.
If we, you know, look, the goal here was to recast the struggle with mental illness as courage and to have the people who are dealing with it and their families and their caregivers and their bosses to understand they're all part of an effort. So, you know, for a long time I watched, you know, it's not enough to be right. People like Patrick in their advocacy have been right about what needs to be done for a frighteningly long time. The question is, what do you do to make these people who are right get done what they know needs to be done? And part of the way that you do that is to make sure that everybody understands they can be part of this. So the first thing people can do, I hate to say this because it sounds like what an author says, but, you know, read the book, because the idea of the book was to give people a starting point, not just for policy, but for the real world of the illnesses. If they understand what's at stake, they are much more likely to be open to the kinds of policy changes that we need, which are not so innovative. I mean, the thing, if you study mental health policy history, people have come up with solutions for this a lot of times. They don't get funded for more than a year, or you get a law passed and it's hard to get it operationalized. I mean, Patrick's been trying to operationalize his Mental Health Parity Act since 2008. It's much easier said than done. But how it gets done is if more and more people understand that this is one of their issues to vote for, and that their public officials understand that this is one of the things that people are going to vote for. And the way to do that is for them to come together in a Profiles in Mental Health Courage community. So, you know, we thought that part of the reason to use that title means something to Americans. It originally, you know, Patrick's uncle wrote Profiles in Courage because he wanted to encourage the political courage it would take to get over the McCarthy era, to deal with the world in the Cold War, for people to understand what it was right to do, what to do the right thing, and how courageous that was. And we want people to think the same way about this, because that's the way we make progress in this area.